Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We've heard of forecasting with regards to weather, fashion, and business, but there's also forecasting when it comes to food. There's a whole industry around eating trends and habits. Has it crossed your mind when all of a sudden you see cake pops in every bakery, kale in every salad, and frosé on every drink menu? Kim Severson is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and four-time James Beard Award winner who has been talking to food forecasters for an annual article in the New York Times since 2016. And she joins now to talk about what we might be seeing on menus this year. Kim, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
So who are these forecasters and how do they gather their data?
It's very mysterious. They're like the witches around the big soup cauldron. No, they're not really. But everybody from, you know, General Mills and the big food companies to sociologists, there are companies that go around the globe looking for trends. So it seems like anybody's got an interest in food and beverage has trend predictors. You know, I spoke to someone from Nestle and I was like, so what's going on? And they're like, we're going to have carbon neutral Pellegrino bottles in 4 years. And I was like, okay, is that a fad, a trend? I don't know. Is that real? Is it marketing? So everybody's trying to get a piece of it. I kind of have to weigh the ones that are trying to sell product versus who are true trend spotters. And then of course, you know, trends, they have different layers. You know, there are cutting edge trends. There are trends among Gen Z. There are trends among people who are 65. So it's a mishmash of a world.
Can you walk us through, for example, how food forecasting might bring about pistachio everywhere or salted caramel lattes everywhere?
Sure.
How does that?
Sure. Some of them are simply like high-end chefs doing something that then, through the great American cultural sluice box, ends up mass marketed. So you may think of garlic mashed potatoes, right, which are, you know, like kind of an old school thing. But back in the day, it was sort of it was a San Francisco chef who roasted some garlic, put it in mashed potatoes, put it on a high-end restaurant menu. And then through the magic of American culture, it ends up at every Boston Market, you know, restaurant forever. So salted caramel was a similar thing. It's a specific caramel from Brittany that some high-end chefs kind of got into using and discovering. There was a time when a lot of chefs were traveling to different parts of France and they brought back the salted caramel. And then same thing, people spot the trend. They say, oh, salted caramel is going to be very hot. Then the mass marketers get a hold of it. And then the next thing you know, we have salted caramel Dunkin' Donut coffee. So that's kind of one level of trend. Mm-hmm. And then there are more long lasting things. Like for example, right now, climate change is top of mind for a lot of people, particularly for Gen Z. And so a lot of the trends we're going to see next year are kind of related to climate change. Edible spoons, for example, edible bowls. So the people are trying to think of ways to stop the waste stream. And there's this whole new generation of, you know, cups that you can get your coffee in that are edible. They're sort of like, if you think about like what the ice cream cone and a dairy cone, Dairy Queen, you know, they're sort of like that, but more durable. So that is an example of people concerned about waste stream, you know, climate change. Kelp is very big. They're trying to figure out ways to put kelp in all kinds of things beyond seaweed salads and that sort of thing. So kelp sauces, because kelp takes, you know, can help take the carbon out of the nitrogen out of the ocean and sequester carbon down in the ocean floor. So kelp is a really great thing for the ocean. And if you can find more ways to use it. So that's how it kind of goes.
That's interesting. It brings me to my next question. You're talking about external forces, which then sort of fuel the trends or are catalysts for the trend. The external force of the pandemic and COVID-19, did it have any kind of impact on some of the forecasting we're seeing for the future or trends for the next year?
Well, see, this gets us into why it can be dangerous to predict trends. And again, results are not guaranteed here. I'm just telling you what they're saying. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know. But I think it, when I did this last year, at the beginning of 2021, people were predicting that the summer was going to be like the roaring 20s, the champagne cork could pop out of the bottle, the vaccine, we were going to see a resurgence of restaurants, you know, sort of tighter, more compact menus, but a lot of people going out, there was going to be a lot of revival, that sort of thing. That obviously didn't happen. Some things did happen. The ghost kitchens that came up in food delivery and restaurants doing all kinds of things like maybe pantry items or wine, you know, other things than just a straight kind of entree that you buy. So that started during the pandemic, and that's kind of got some legs. There are a lot of chefs and restaurants, companies that are doing nothing but what they call ghost kitchens. They'll have four or five brands you can order online. You see the rise of instant Instagram ordering, and there are a lot of people who are doing their food just through Instagram. All of that happened in the pandemic, and I think that's really going to stick around and evolve.
My guest is Kim Severson from the New York Times. We're talking food forecasting. All right, let's get into 2022. New ways to eat chicken. It tastes like chicken.
You know, the poor chicken. It is tastes. Everything tastes like chicken. Chicken is, you know, I feel kind of bad for chicken. Chicken is the number one protein that we eat in this country, so it makes sense that some of the trends would play out on the backs of the poor chicken. You know, we all saw the rise of Impossible Food and Beyond Burger, Beyond Meat's burgers, but now the battle is on for the chicken nugget or the chicken tender. I think KFC now has is trying a plant-based chicken nugget. They're trying to figure out the texture and what's going to sort of be the best flavor profile. There are a lot of smaller companies that are coming up. So we're going to see a big battle for the plant-based chicken. And in the real chicken arena, or sort of real, they're developing a lot of cultured or lab-grown chicken right now that take a chicken cell of some kind, meat, feather, whatever, put it through a process, and they can grow chicken flesh, essentially. So that probably won't be approved for consumption till maybe the end of the year, but it's already, there's some versions of it for sale in Singapore. It's an Israeli restaurant that's got testing out some cellular grown chicken. So that's it. And then, of course, you know, the poor chicken wing, of which we know has gotten very popular, and there seems like there's always a shortage. So I think there's some chain restaurants who are trying to get us to think about eating something other than wings. You know, Wingstop now has a little sub brand called Thigh Stop that you can order online. So chicken, lots happening in chicken. Big, so big deal in chicken.
So there are chicken wing supply chain issues? Is that what I'm hearing?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry to tell you. But and it kind of comes, you know, I always think there's a little bit of, I'm always a little suspicious because it seems like right around Super Bowl time, there's always a chicken wing shortage. And certainly people do eat a lot of wings on Super Bowl. But I sometimes suspect there's a little market manipulation on the part of Big Chicken. And they say, oh, my God, there's a wing shortage. We all want to run out and get wings. So I will blow the lid off of that one day, I promise.
What about you mentioned the plant-based meats. Are they here to stay?
Oh, yeah, I think that they'll have a place. It's interesting because there's the battle of people who want to eat clean, as they say, which I think is kind of a funny thing, but who want to really are concerned about putting things in their body that have fewer ingredients on the ingredient label that are less processed, more whole foods. And there's a Venn diagram where those people kind of meet with people who are eating, want to eat vegan or want to eat less meat. And so they've all kind of turned to the Impossible Burger, but the Impossible and Beyond Burger, those are very processed things. You know, it's pea protein and they have to do a lot of chemical work to make them like bleed like meat, you know? So I think we're starting to see some people peeling away from those who eat a certain way. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people, there's a chain that started here in Atlanta where I live now called Slutty Vegan that has lines out the door. It's a,
so funny, you know, I saw that today, this morning.
Yeah, Slutty Vegan. She's big. She just was on the cover of Essence, and she just started a little Impossible Burger stand that got very popular. People would wait for 3 or 4 hours. You know, it was kind of a scene to be in line. So there is certainly, and she said, I'm not trying to attract vegans here. I'm just trying to get, you know, people to maybe think about eating something besides beef for a minute. So I think it's going to be real interesting to watch how the plant-based meat develops.
We're talking about food forecasting. My guest is Kim Severson from the New York Times. Let's talk drinks.
Oh my
coffee.
Goodness.
The next thing, and what else are they going to do to coffee?
Right. Well, now we're going, instead of going up the scale with the coffee, we're going a little sort of down the scale. There's, two kinds of coffee. Robusta has been the less expensive coffee that grows. The beans are more heavily caffeinated. It's a more bitter bean, but it grows in, it's a little easier to grow in more regions. And as climate change is threatening some of the really more pristine coffee growing regions, we're seeing an interest in this Robusta coffee, because it used to be what they would put into like instant coffee. However, they're finding ways to roast it in better ways. And because there's a real interest in Vietnamese coffee houses now, and that's if most people who either have been to Vietnam or from Vietnam know the kind of condensed milk, strong coffee, Vietnamese coffee thing. So Robusta works really well in that. And Robusta beans happen to be the number one predominant bean grown in Vietnam. So, and it's also cheaper, right? So right now money matters. Things are expensive. Mm-hmm. And so Robusta may have a shot at knocking off all those precious third wave pour over people. I don't know.
What does the taste like?
It stands up really well against, condensed milk or cream or, I think it has a lot of potential. There are some people who will say it's awful and they will never drink it, but, I think it's got some legs.
When you were describing its origin story, maybe think of like Beaujolais.
Yeah. Right. Oh my gosh. Now that was a big, there's a marketing gimmick gone crazy. I mean, there's some really great Beaujolais wines, but if you recall the Beaujolais Nouveau hysteria that happened back in the day, it was like, oh, the first Beaujolais is going to come out usually in November, and only certain restaurants could get it, and it was a big rush, and everybody got excited about it and drank it for their Thanksgiving wine, and that was a great piece of marketing, and it's, I think it's a good wine, but like you mentioned, Frosé, these things have their arc and their fall, so...
80s drinks.
Okay, now this one, you talk about where trends come from. No idea why this one is coming up, but it got mentioned by a couple people, particularly there's a guy, Andrew Freeman, who has been watching food trends for many, many years, who I trust a lot and has a whole army of people. So remember the 80s? Well, you probably don't remember the 80s cocktails.
Well,
because they were designed to have you forget everything, like the Long Island iced teas and the Harvey Wallbangers. And, I think I drank those. I can't remember. But anyway, they're making a comeback. So the kind of, and anything with like blue, or Midori, you remember that green Midori?
Oh,
like,
God.
So cocktails with these kind of throwback 80s liquors.
You're taking me back to limelight times.
Right? Are we like, but they have a lot less sugar, fresher juices, kind of a more culinary forward approach with this kind of kitschy throwback scaffolding. So look for those. Get on your Long Island iced tea kick.
Woo, I don't know. This chassis's old. I don't think I can take it.
Exactly.
There's some new language, some new terms. I think they're portmanteaus. Swicy and swalty.
Oh my God. I feel so bad for words sometimes when they mix with food, like food trends. You may remember for a while we were having, Sammy's and Evu, and then it evolved. Mm. And last year, all the kids were talking about putting together their charcuterie plate, or eating their Caesar, their Caesar salad. And so so now we've moved out of the kind of cutesy nickname era, and we're entering into kind of a mashup era. So swicy, something that's sweet and spicy. And you've already seen this, like there's hot honey is kind of big now. And there's a lot of, certainly that there's a real Korean flavor profile that matches sweet and hot on fried chicken, for example. So swicy, swalty, things that are sweet and salty. There's a South Korean based chicken chain called Neen that's, moving into North America now. It's up in Canada. I think it's going to come here. But they even have a sauce called Swicy that you can order for your Korean-style fried chicken. So word mashups, I'm sorry to say, are going to be happening.
They're here to stay. What will be the ingredient of the year?
Oh, this was a little bit of a battle. I sort of just almost keep like a a tally, and people talk about ingredients and flavors of the year. And so the mushroom has emerged, as unsexy it is. And I always feel like mushrooms always on somebody's list, but this year it was on a lot of lists for a couple of reasons. They're certainly play a big role for people who are eating vegan, and you can turn mm-hmm. mushrooms into all kinds of things. They can work in like tacos. You can cut the big king oyster mushrooms into slices to be scallop style, you know, dish. So there's that. A lot of small urban farms are popping up growing mushrooms. So we're seeing a more variety. People learn to cook a little bit more during the pandemic. So they're maybe more interested in varieties of mushrooms. So there's some interest in different mushrooms. Also mushrooms, mushroom fibers are starting to be kind of a cool thing. I was at an interview with Stella McCartney, who is a vegan and does fashion, and was talking about trying to figure out how to do mushroom leather. And there are like mushroom fibers that you're kind of seeing as packing, mm-hmm. compostable packing stuff. And let's not forget microdosing. There's people are interested in psychedelics. And for those people who know Michael Pollan, the food writer, he's very into microdosing, psilocybin mushrooms. So we may see shrooms in that realm being big. So all of this adds up to the mushroom.
Year of the shroom.
Year of the shroom, my friend.
What about a flavor of the year?
This one was a tight battle. And at the end of the day, it kind of came to lots of people mentioning yuzu, which is that sort of citrusy kind of tart flavor, and hibiscus. And in the grand smackdown, I think more people thought hibiscus would be more popular. You'd see it in things like yogurt and in, sauces for crudos, that sort of thing. It's got that really bright pink color. And in our Instagram era, I think it pops more than the yuzu. That could be in its favor. Different Caribbean cuisines, particularly really drilling down to more regional Caribbean cuisine. And, you know, hibiscus can and sorrel, that plays a lot of roles in beverages and stuff in Caribbean. So that may be influencing the hibiscus trend a little bit. I don't know, but that's what they're saying.
And finally, the vibe of the year.
Oh, this one. And I had to really, I kept telling my editors, they're like, really? And I'm like, no, people are talking about it. So the vibe of the year, it's a new emphasis on kindness and understanding. And I think this, I know, right? And
I
was sitting in my meditation minute, it's been a very stressful couple of years. We've all sort of realized that we can't, you know, at the end of the day, really all we have is each other and being nice to each other. So there's that. But we've all gotten used to supply chain. We went through the shock of like, this is America. There should be everything on the shelf that I always want whenever I want it. And we've started to understand that that's not possible. So we're learning to not yell at the poor person stocking our shelves that there's no, you know, tropical fruit Gatorade today. Right. And also, I think restaurants were really, a lot of people in the service industry, you know, say they've just been, got really harassed. You remember the case in New York, the poor woman who was checking vaccine cards and, got nailed for that. So I think we're realizing that being understanding of people's situations, having more patience, you know, that we realize that not everything's going to happen just when we want it. I think we've really gone through a transformational time in America, understanding that we don't get everything we want when we want it. And asking to speak to the manager is maybe not so cool next year.
No Karen behavior.
Thank you.
I actually have a t-shirt that says "Be kind, it's gangster," and I always get a thumb up.
This is it. You're going to make $1 million off of that t-shirt in 2022.
My guest has been Kim Severson from the New York Times. We were talking about food forecasting for 2022. Kim, it was a pleasure to have you. Come back anytime.
I always love it.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.